This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Chants of death to America, as crowds of Iranians, by some reports thousands or millions, took to the streets of Tehran after today's funeral for Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's leaders have vowed revenge on the U.S. for killing Soleimani in a drone strike last week. Meanwhile, closer to home, Congress is back in D.C. this week. So how are they grappling with these latest events? Let's catch up with WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins, who joins us now from Washington. Kimberly, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, pull up a chair. How are you grappling with this growing Middle East crisis? Where does it go from here? Do you think war with Iran is on the table, or should it be? We want you to share your thoughts. Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Kimberly, Congress is back from the holiday break. What is the mood there?
Well, they're making their way back. Most lawmakers will be back here by tomorrow. And the focus is entirely different from when they left. Then it was almost laser focused on impeachment and what would happen next. Since that strike in Iraq that killed Soleimani, the focus is squarely on Iran, with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi setting the tone and announcing that she would put forward a war power Act legislation to vote that would limit President Trump's ability to do more, to conduct further raids without coming to Congress first to get authorization.
There's something in that War Power Act vote that would essentially put a 30-day limit without further congressional authorization. Is that correct?
That's correct. It really would limit. And what it's aimed at doing is it's an effort by the members of Congress who support this to say, look, you did this strike, but overall war powers lie within the Congress. Congress must give their approval, and it's to prevent the president from engaging in further action that could escalate the situation without congressional oversight.
So we're about 4 days into this now, Kimberly. Do we actually know any more today about either the strike, how it came about, the decision making, than we did last week?
No, because so far the justification that has been put forward by the White House to Congress is classified. Now, members of Congress, including the Gang of Eight, are set to be briefed about that classified information on Wednesday at 2:30 p.m. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Defense Secretary Esper, and some others are going to brief members of Congress. Then might we find out more after that? We'll have to see. It depends on whether this information is declassified.
So it's possible that Congress will know more after Wednesday, but the American people won't be able to make up their own minds because they may not have the information. It may be classified.
That is a possibility, which is why you have heard an increasing number of members of Congress, particularly Democrats, calling for that information to be declassified, or at least parts of it to be declassified, so that the American people can get more information.
And do you happen to know if that's a normal thing to do, to declassify information like that?
It really depends. Generally speaking, no. A lot of things, if they are sensitive, the default is to keep it classified until it is certain that it won't affect any sort of military operation. Certainly, if it were to put American citizens or troops in danger, it would remain classified. But in this sense, we also have a situation where, particularly if the recent Afghanistan papers that were published about how the justification for past military action has not matched with what was actually happening, and then further erosion of trust in that, you're seeing more pressure to be more transparent about military action rather than just saying, hey, we're going to trust the officials, we're going to trust the intelligence that they are telling us what is actually happening.
Okay, so meanwhile, while all this is unfolding, the impeachment situation is still out there. Any sense of how this might impact a potential Senate trial or the rules of such a trial?
Well, it's just one other big news item that is sitting on top of this impending impeachment. We return to Congress essentially in the same place where we left on impeachment, which is Speaker Pelosi is still holding the impeachment article. She has not yet advanced them. And Senate leader Mitch McConnell saying that he hopes to have a fast trial, is really trying to push against the desire by Democrats to call witnesses. So we'll see how things play out moving forward.
So White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway spoke to reporters today, clearly putting pressure on Nancy Pelosi, questioning why the speaker would delay sending the articles. Let's listen.
She's flouting the Constitution again. They know their case is weak. They know their case was very obtuse, was very weak. They're very specious, and she won't send those over. So, but delay a trial for what reason? I mean, let's get on with it already.
So you've got that argument, and then, you know, this new national security situation. As you said, you know, the focus has changed entirely. Does this place new pressure on Speaker Pelosi one way or the other about those articles?
Well, that's the line coming from the White House, and it has been pretty consistently that Nancy Pelosi is sort of losing ground here because she's not moving forward. Democratic aides are telling me today that it's quite the opposite, particularly given the announcement by former National Security Advisor John Bolton that he would be willing to testify if he's subpoenaed by the Senate. They say that the best leverage that Nancy Pelosi and Democrats could get in holding these impeachment articles is to force witness testimony, and that it makes it much harder with Bolton saying he would come testify for Republicans, including some vulnerable Republicans who are seeking re-election, to force the hand and not let that happen. Remember, it only takes four Republicans in the Senate to push for a rule that would require, that would have John Bolton subpoenaed and have him brought in.
So you're there. Any sense, you know, any rumblings that something like this change in opinion approach from Bolton might move some Republican senators and cause the Senate to rethink taking witnesses right off the bat?
Well, we don't know exactly what will happen, but the sense has been for a long time that there would be some sort of compromise. Nancy Pelosi wouldn't get everything that she wanted, but Mitch McConnell probably wouldn't be able to hold the line where he's been holding either. And this new announcement by Bolton, I think, increases the likelihood that they'll have to come together and try to hash out some sort of compromise. It might involve things like videotaped witness testimony, like we saw in the Clinton trial. But that's where the momentum is heading right now.
So in just our last few seconds, Kimberly, with impeachment, Iran, Iraq, is it possible for Congress to advance any other kind of policy agenda in the next few months?
Yeah, look, it's tough. So far, Congress has been able to do the bare minimum, pass funding measures that keep the lights on in the federal government and its agencies, essentially. It's not just impeachment that's keeping that from happening. It's just the partisanship that has really brought Congress to a halt over the past several years. The House has passed hundreds of bills that have zero chance in the Senate. So in that sense, it's kind of business as usual.
That is WBUR senior news correspondent in Washington, Kimberly Atkins. Hey, thanks, Kimberly.
Always good to join you.
You know, we asked you, listeners, how do you feel about the situation confronting us with Iran? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anne is on the line from Fenway. Anne, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm in Fenway Studios in Boston. I'm an artist. And that this man, that Trump is threatening to bomb cultural sites like Persepolis, I feel we have absolutely no control over him. The whole assassination was ordered by one person, by Trump. And I'm also connected to Persians because my cousin was married to an Iranian. I was very close to the whole family. And no way are they not going to, out of pride and our respect for them, react to what happened.
And as an artist, how does it feel to you to think of a cultural site being threatened?
Just a crime, just horrible. If he suddenly bombs Persepolis and we have no control over him, it's a crime against the arts, against history, against this civilization. He has no respect for the Persian or Iranian civilization
that went on
much longer than us.
Thank you so much for that call. And that gives us a chance to stay with Iran and invite perspective from Andrew Basevich. He's president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft in Washington, professor emeritus of military history at BU, Boston University, and author of a new book out tomorrow, The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. Professor Basevich, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you very much.
What's your reaction to Anne's call?
Well, I think that for for the United States to intentionally destroy cultural sites would be a war crime. And it would be despicable. I have to agree 100%.
Let me back up for a second and ask you if you think there's justification for the killing of Soleimani. Representative Michael Waltz, Florida Republican, argued that it was irresponsible not to have acted. He said, quote, "We don't wait until there's additional American body bags coming home to then stop the threat," end quote. What do you make of that argument?
Well, if we go back to the immediate aftermath of 9/11, President Bush, George W. Bush, articulated what was really a doctrine of preventive war that was used to justify the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And that also was a criminal act, an illegal war. And this is, I'm sad to say, has now become sort of part of the American MO. That said, there's a separate question, I think equally important, and that is, does the killing of Soleimani make any sense? I mean, does it in fact...
Do you mean strategic sense?
Yes. Does it make us safer? And at least the early readout on that would be absolutely not.
Why? Why do you say that?
We don't understand the way the president makes decisions, but it's pretty clear that he does not make decisions after having carefully consulted with his advisors and weighing the evidence pro and cons and thinking about what might be the second order or third order consequences. It does appear that he's a shoot from the hip kind of guy. It does appear that that's what he did in this instance. And that tends to be a recipe for foolishness, for policies that produce all kinds of negative consequences. We don't know what the negative consequences are going to be in this instance, because the ball is now in Iran's court. It's up to them to decide how they are going to respond. I would say that the fears that we are on the verge of something akin to World War III are probably overheated.
But what is a likely
response? The Iranians are not stupid. They will take their time, just like Nancy Pelosi in impeachment. They will take their time in considering what action to take, and then they will initiate it on terms and in a way that will maximize their advantage.
I'm going to break in here for just a minute. I want to get another call in, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul is calling us from Somerville. Paul, what do you want to share with Professor Bacevich?
Yeah, two quick things. First of all, given Trump's long-standing sociopathic behavior and doing policy on a whim, I think it's very possible that he did this attack just to divert attention from impeachment. Secondly, the reason Nancy Pelosi is holding back the articles of impeachment is that she knows Mitch McConnell, whose only mission is to protect Trump, will ram this through as fast as possible. She's waiting for more evidence and public opinion to sway in her favor.
Paul, thanks for that. And before I invite you to respond to that, Andrew, I do want to note that there have been other administrations that have considered killing Soleimani in the past. You know, Paul used some pretty strong language about the president there, calling him a sociopath. This isn't the first time this option has been placed on the table. That being said, how do you react to Paul's call?
Well, I mean, on the point, we need to recall that it was President Obama who pioneered the policy of assassination using drones. Now, he didn't target anyone that is as high profile as this guy. But the president, however stupid this act was, in a sense, it was not unprecedented. I mean, to me, the larger issue here is that the United States, for decades now, and particularly since 9/11, has had a propensity for using force, with policymakers assuming that somehow or other, if we invade enough countries or bomb enough places, that order will be restored to the Middle East. Oddly enough, it was Trump who said, in running for the presidency in 2016, that this entire enterprise was stupid, and he promised to end endless war. Sadly, what we now have is this same president who is perpetuating endless war, and if things go badly, could actually be making things much worse.
So I have to ask
the
you.
Notion, but let me just emphasize, you know, a discussion that says Trump is the problem, I think, is wildly wrong and fails to take into account the others who perpetrated this circumstance in which we find ourselves.
You know, you called the president's decision in this case stupid. There are people who have argued that this kind of more forceful approach is what is required in the current situation. And there are, for example, Republican elected officials who are celebrating this move by the president.
Of course they do. Of course they do. Because they reflect a militarized mindset that is pervasive in the foreign policy establishment. At the present moment, we note that more among Republicans than Democrats, but let us remember the track record of somebody like Hillary Clinton voting for the Iraq War, celebrating the intervention in Libya that turned Libya into an anarchical state. So there is a larger problem of people who are infatuated with military power, and that problem also predates Donald Trump by a very a significant number of years.
Let's take another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jeff's on the line from Linfield. Jeff, what's on your mind?
Yes, well, you know, I'm an independent voter, and I voted for Trump. I'm going to vote for him again because the professor here, you know, he just mentioned about Nancy Pelosi is bringing this impeachment process slowly. Yeah, because she has nothing, okay? They're waiting for something to bring, and they have nothing. And Donald Trump is cleaning up the mess that Obama and Clinton, other people that have allowed Iran and Iraq to think that they're bigger players than they really are. And God bless Donald Trump.
All right, let's turn it back to Andrew Bacevich. What's your response there?
Well, he's not cleaning up the mess. I mean, that's what he promised to do. He promised to extricate us from these endless wars in the Middle East. He denounced the invasion of Iraq as the stupidest thing we ever done, and in fact, he's not ended those wars, and because of the folly of this assassination, there is at least some realistic possibility that we will get ourselves in a wider war. I hope it doesn't happen, but quite frankly, if we avoid a wider war, it's probably going to be because of decisions made in Tehran rather than made in the White House.
So what are the likely or possible decisions that could be made in Tehran now?
Well, my guess, and I'm guessing, so I'm not pretend to read the minds of decision makers in Tehran, but my guess is that there will be retaliatory action, but it'll likely be retaliatory action through proxies. So they'll try to disguise direct involvement of Iran. That'll make it more difficult for the president then to further escalate without paying a political price of his own. So it's not they're not going to respond to this assassination with Pearl Harbor. They're going to act in ways that will make it very difficult for the hawks to make a case that further escalation is in the interests of the United States.
Is there 1 minute of historical context that you can give us that you think is important to understand as we consider, as an American people, what the right next step is?
Yeah, I mean, quite frankly, it's that, decision makers opt to use force because they think they're in charge. They think they can control what happens next. This has happened over and over again. Given where I am and my background in life, I think the most vivid case is the Vietnam War. When the United States Americanized the Vietnam War in 1965, Lyndon Johnson, Robert McNamara, General William Westmoreland, they thought they could control the direction of events in the war, and they utterly miscalculated. The war got totally out of control, with awful consequences for us and, frankly, awful consequences for the Vietnamese people. So this notion that you can make a decision, strike, employ force, and determine what's going to happen next has been proven over the course of history over and over again to be a fallacy.
So given that, in your mind, what should happen next? What is a smart strategy for the United States now?
Well, I mean, you're going to think I'm making a joke here. But a smart strategy would be for the president to seize the opportunity offered to him by the Iraqi parliament, which wants the United States, U.S. forces to leave the country. I think that's what we should do.
You think we should just pull out?
Exactly.
What about the implications? Go ahead.
Let me explain, if I may. Okay.
You may.
Okay. And the implications here are is that would de facto constitute an admission that the American effort to, using force, fix the Middle East had irretrievably failed. And that would, in turn, in my judgment, trigger a massive reevaluation of U.S. national security policy at home. In other words, the hawks would be finally and deservedly discredited. And the opportunity for a debate about basic U.S. policy based on principles like prudence, restraint, diplomacy, might actually have a chance of being heard. We are badly in need of that basic debate. And simply to persist in the Middle East militarily is only going to compound the errors that we have been making for the last two decades.
Would that in the short term destabilize further situations like Syria or our ongoing efforts in Afghanistan?
Wait. Where did destabilization come from?
I don't know.
Destabilization comes from invading Iraq in 2003.
Okay, but we are where we are now. But we are where we are now. I'm really asking you, if we do what you're suggesting, would there be short-term...
What you're saying is, does the United States have the capacity to undo the damage that it has done? Can we restabilize the region? And the answer to your question really is, look at our efforts since Iraq fell apart. We have been trying to. We have been trying to use the United States military as an instrument to create stability in a part of the world where they are not wanted. So you could say, one could say, well, let's just try it for another 20 years, and maybe that will actually turn out to be the case. My argument would be that we've tried this long enough, and the use of American military power in that part of the world is absolutely counterproductive. It has cost us dearly. The estimates on the Iraq war itself are now somewhere in the vicinity of $6 trillion. Tens of thousands of people killed. I'm just not in the mood to keep trying. I think maybe it's time to try something different.
All right. Andrew Bacevich is president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft in Washington, professor emeritus of military history at Boston University, and author of the new book, The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. Professor Bacevich, thanks for joining us. Let's have you back on soon to discuss your book.
Oh, I'd enjoy that.
And we will have a link on our webpage, radioboston.org, to Professor Bacevich's just-published Boston Globe op-ed on this topic as well. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.